From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, the light side of the Dark Ages, medieval English humor. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guests are Morton Bloomfield of Harvard University and Stephen Spector of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. According to Morton Bloomfield and Stephen Spector, medieval English literature differs by comparison with modern English not only in the way it sounds, but also in its presentation of humor and profanity. Here is Morton Bloomfield.
Well, we're going to read a rather amusing one because, after all, this is what this meeting is about, something called the Land of Cocaine, mm-hmm. which is about a monastery that never really existed.
Now, wait, let me stop you. The Land of Cocaine, we have a deceptive word on the table. We're not talking about Miami Vice here. We're talking cocaine means what?
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten. Cocaine means cookery.
Cookery.
That's right. Yeah. Something like the Land of Cakes.
The uh-huh. Land of Cakes, or things
the word,
that you've cooked.
The word cocaine, as it's used today, has only been in use for about 100 years.
Uh-huh. Morton Bloomfield, The Land of Cocaine. Let's hear what Middle English sounds like.
Well, first I'm going to read a little of it in Middle English,
all right.
Which is more understandable, although not completely understandable, for moderns. Begins this way. It's a poem with four stresses in each line. Fuer in se be west Espana is a land of hot cocaine. There nis land under heaven richer of well of goodness het ilicha. Troch paradis be miri in bricht, cocaine is a fairer seat. What is there in paradis but grass and floor and grain of ris? Though there be joy and greater duta, there is not there nis met bota fruta. There nis hall, boora, no bencha, but water manas thirst to quencha. Far in the sea, in near West Spain, is a land called Cocaine. There is no land under heaven's realm of well-being or like it in goodness. Though paradise be merry and bright, cocaine is fair of fairer sight. What is there in paradise but grass and flowers and branches? Though there be joy and great rejoicing, there is not any food but fruit. There is no hall, bower, nor bench, only water man's thirst to quench. We have food brought to us and presumably clean and fixed, and we can't fall into trouble with eating uh-huh. Unless we want to deliberately or something of
is
that
Is this
sort.
What you would call utopian?
Yes, it's a utopia. Right. It's a kind of uh-huh. primitive utopian, which was even used as late as the Renaissance.
What the lines express, and there are other poems that also express the yearning to be in a paradise. These represent a sense of deprivation, and mm-hmm. we can infer from these paradises, from the qualities in them, what was missing or longed for in the real world. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, and this is a very different phenomenon from the modern one, there's also a sense of spiritual temptation mm-hmm. and of spiritual restraint. Well, what happened? Let me summarize what's going to come after this, and then we'll read a bit more of the poem later on. Having run down the qualities of paradise as being sort of much inferior to that of cocaine, the narrator then goes on to say, you know, there's only two men in paradise anyway, Elijah and Enoch. Those were the two figures who were thought to have ascended directly to heaven. This is, however, prior to the intervention of Christ. So this is a sense of deliberately pre-Christian perspective that's being adopted. And there's no more men than that, says the narrator, who needs it. And cocaine, by contrast, there's meat and drink, there's no care, there's no work. The meat is true, the drink is clear, and you have it three meals a day, which tells us something about what's missing in the real world for this poet. All right, he says, there's a great deal of joy and bliss, there are sweet sights, there's only day, it's never night, and there's never death, there's only life. No man or woman is ever wroth, or no serpents, wolves, or foxes. And he goes on to describe the four rivers that flow through this land of cocaine, one of oil, another of milk, another honey, another wine, in parody of the four rivers of Eden. What it is the equivalent of a modern get-rich-quick scheme. It is the medieval get-to-paradise in a hurry.
Yeah.
And we have other such yearnings, but always they're suppressed by the end of the poem.
Uh-huh.
One of the other features of this land is that geese are already roasted on the spit. They fly down from the sky and go right into your mouth. Sort of like an American television commercial.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Steve Inspector, this reminds me of the idealized, sanitized, wonderful world that exists in the ethic of American commercial radio and TV.
That is precisely it.
Everybody's healthy, everybody's happy, everybody's well-fed, and nobody worries about paying for things. You just got all this wonderful stuff in front of you. Martin Bloomfield?
That's absolutely right. It's fantastic. Shall I continue reading?
Please do.
I'll read a little in Middle English. The young monks each day after maid goeth to play. There is hawk, there's no hawk nor fowl, so bird so swift, better fleeing by the lift. Then the monks high of mode with their sleeves and with their hoods. When the abbot sees them flee, that he considers for much glee. But nevertheless, among them he biddeth them light to evening, to come down for evening, for the evening serve song, the vespers, and so forth. All it goes on. And the monks taketh a maiden of the root, takes a woman of the root, and turns up her white buttocks, and beateth that with his hand the small drums.
Isn't this going a little too far to talk this way about nuns?
Not for the Middle Ages, nor either for the Renaissance, actually.
Why would this be? I mean, how did this justify itself?
Remember, we've all gone through the Victorian Age, and that's made us a little more particular about our bad words. They bowdlerized our language, and today we have a very, very strong attitude against the use of bad words. Mm-hmm. However, since in the last 10 years there's been some changes in that too, and now we are beginning to use words that we never used before openly.
Uh-huh. Steve Inspector?
We've entered at this point in the poem into a Hugh Hefner-like world, where the monks just take their choice of available unnamed maidens.
Goodness.
And then they thack them on the toot, which is the way the Middle English reads. But we can't pass judgment yet.
Why not?
Until we come to the end of the poem, and you'll see why.
All right. Let's proceed to that point. Do we need some paraphrase between where we are and the end of the poem, Stephen?
All right, here's some Middle English, and I'll translate. Another abbey is there be, for soth a great fair nunneria, up a river of sweet milk, where is plenty great of silk. Now there's another abbey near this abbey in the land of cocaine, and truly it's a great fair nunnery, up a river of sweet milk, where there's plenty, a plentiful abundance of silk. This delicate naughtiness is suggested through the imagery, which has become extremely feminine at this moment. When the summer's day is hotter, the young nunnes taketh a boat, the young nuns take a boat, and doth them forth in that river, and they get themselves into the river, both with oars and with stair, with oars and with a rudder or steer, and when they bith far from the abbey, he maketh them naked for to play, and when they are far from the abbey, they make themselves naked to play, and leapeth doon into the brimmer, and they leap down into the stream, and doth them slalich for to swimmer, and whatever that means, they make themselves swim slyly. The younger monkus that he saith, he doth them up, and forth he flayeth. And when the monks see that, they ascend and fly, and cometh to the nunnes anon, and each monk him taketh on, and each monk grabs one. And snellich beareth forth her pry to the muchel grey abbey, and teacheth the nunnes an oraison with jambaleva up and doon. And they quickly bear away their prey to the grey abbey, and they teach each of the nuns a prayer, with jambaleva, with a raised leg, up and down.
All right, now that's about as racy as we've gotten here. How could this stuff pass for poetry, given the traditional notions that we have of tolerance and religious circumstances in the Middle Ages? Steve Inspector?
Well, wait for the conclusion, and that will be your answer.
Okay.
The last few lines.
Fire away.
The narrator then says, "Whoso will come to that land to, whoever wants to come to that land, full great penance, he must do a great penance. 7 year in sweenest dritta, he must ward wo ye wit all anon up to the chinna. So he shall the lawn do winna. 7 years in swine's dirt, he must wade, well you know, up to the chin, if he wants to win that land."
It's a pleasant thought. So this is the trade-off, I take it.
the sanitized world you spoke of just a few minutes ago and the Hugh Hefner-like qualities have mm-hmm. been deluged into a scatological revenge. The penance is so offensive that it casts an entirely new perspective on the seduction uh-huh. that the poem has constituted to this point. In a sense, the poet has redeemed himself spiritually, although this is at least formally true, though in a poem nothing is ever negated, although it may be retracted, and we find that same phenomenon in Chaucer.
Mm-hmm. All right, now speaking of Chaucer, Stephen Spector from the State University of New York, Morton Bloomfield from Harvard. Our topic is humor, comedy, potent words, profanity in Old and Middle English. Let's get into some reading of Chaucer here. You have chosen The Miller's Tale. Where shall we begin?
The Canterbury Tales is the last work that Chaucer was working on before he died, and he didn't finish it. But he did finish some 27 or 26 tales, uh-huh. Most of which are actually delightful. They cover a range of all sorts of ideas, from the kind of unrest that goes through some of the stories, but which comes in very, very strongly in others. We have The Knight's Tale, which is the first of the tales, and we have a prologue, which tells us about the pilgrims who are going on their way to Canterbury. And then The Miller's Tale is the second tale that's told that day. It's a kind of a parody of the Knight's Tale, which is a very serious tale about two men who fall in love with the same woman, and who have one of whom finally dies, and the other finally marries the girl. It's a great story, and it's a great poem.
Okay, Stephen Spector, fire away. Let's have some Middle English, some Chaucer, the Miller's Tale.
All right, as Morton has just said, the knight has told his tale, the first in the series. The host, who is sort of in charge of he's the master of ceremonies, in charge of the tale-telling, would like the monk to tell the next tale, but the miller, who's drunk, decides that he's going to speak next, and this is how the Middle English reads. The miller, that for drunken was all pala, so that oneth upon his horse he sat. He knolled of Allah neither hod nor hot, nor beaten no man for his curtis sea. The miller, who was, because he was drunk, was all pale, so he could scarcely sit on his horse. He wouldn't doff either his hood or his hat, he showed no courtesy, nor abide no man for his courtesy. But in Pilate's voice he gone to Crea, like Pontius Pilate in a medieval mystery play, he ranted and swore, be armis and be blood and bonus, by arms and blood and bones. These are great oaths. And we're going to see more about, this is a form of medieval cursing, and we're going to see more about obscenity later on in this text. This is strong language, although today it's almost meaningless. I can a noble tale for the nonnes, I know a noble tale for the time being, with which ye will no quit the knichtis tale, which I'm going to requite the knight's tale. The host saw that he was drunk of ale and said, abide, Robin, hold on, Robin. My dear brother, let some better man tell another tale first. Be God's soul, says the miller, that will not e, for e will spake or else go me why. Well, the entire Canterbury Tales pilgrimage is about to come undone at this point, so the host has to relent and said, tell on a devil way. Go to hell, essentially. Go on, tell your tale. Thou art a fool, thy wit is overcome. You're a fool, your wit is overcome. And the miller says, nu herkeneth, all in summa. Now listen to me, but first I make a protestation, I have to make a protest at first, that I am drunk. I'm going to make that a proviso. I am drunk, I know it be me soon, I hear my voice, I know I'm drunk. And therefore, if that I misspake or say, if I say something wrong, wit it the Isle of Southwark, you prior, blame the ale from the Southwark Inn, from the Tabard Inn in Southwark, you prior, I pray you. For I will tell a legend and a leaf, I will tell a legend and a life, both of a carpenter and of his weave. Now, a legend in Middle English was essentially a saint's life. Mm-hmm. And he has promised to tell a saint's life about a carpenter and his wife. He's going to tell this legend and life of a carpenter of a wife, and how a clerk has set the richtis kappa, how that the clerk has fixed the carpenter's wagon, essentially. Uh-huh. So we're not going to get a story about Mary and Joseph. Instead, we're going to get what's called a fabliau. A medieval genre, which essentially was French, and there aren't many of them in English, but it's essentially it's a ribald tale, which is in part Darwinian. It has mm-hmm. to do with a sexual liaison from which there often has to be an escape through wit.
All right, so we're at the point where the miller is about to begin his tale. Here we're reading from Middle English from Chaucer. Morton Bloomfield, you take it from there.
The tale begins with the story about Nicholas and his girlfriend and the carpenter who is the father of or the husband of the girlfriend, an old man, a Senex Amans, an old lover, as he's called by scholars who talk about this sort of thing. Formerly there was dwelling in Oxford a rich knough, a rich fellow who held guests, who took guests to board, and of his craft he was a carpenter. With him there was dwelling a poor scholar, and this is Nicholas, who is the main character. He had learned art, but all his fantasy was turned to teach and learn astrology. And he knew a certain number of conclusions. He knew how to judge things by the hours of the day and by everything else. And this clerk was called Nicholas. This carpenter had led recently a wife, which he had loved more than all his life. Of 18 years of age she was, and he was jealous, and he held her narrowly in a cage, for she was wild and young, and he was old, and deemed himself to be a cuckold, which he turns out to be, and probably had already been. Fair was this young wife, and therewithal as any weasel, her body gently and small. She wore a belt around her, barred all of silk with bars of silk, a barm cloth as white as any milk, some kind of cloth that she wore. Upon her loins full many a gore, little triangles which were put into the dress. Her mouth was sweet as braggart or the mead, or hoard of apples laid in hay or heath. Winsome she was, as is a jolly colt, long as a mask and upright as a bolt, a brooch she bore. This is one of the great descriptive passages in Chaucer. She wore upon her low collar as broad as is the boss of a buckler, which is part of a little shield that the knights wore. Her shoes were laced on her high legs, and she was a primerole, a pig's eye. Which was a compliment, a pig's eye, for any lord to lay in his bed, and yet for any good yeoman to wed.
Stephen Spector.
Having heard this seductive description of the wife, which she's compared to good things to eat and drink, and lots of tactile images, and mm-hmm. lots of small animals, she's associated almost with nature itself in an amoral context. Mm-hmm. And having heard the sexual suggestion at the end that she'd be good for a lord to take to bed or for a yeoman to wed, indicating the difference in social privilege, we get into the plot. Nusser and Efser, so befell the cas, that on a day this hen de Nicholas, filled with his younger wife to Raj and Playa, wheeled that her husband was at Azanea. Well, it just happened, it fell out one day, that this hen de Nicholas, this Nicholas who was handy in the sense of nearby and good with his hands and other meanings as well, fell with his young wife to rage and play while her husband was out of town at a place called Azanea. As clerk has been full subtle and full quaint, since you know that clerical students in universities are very subtle and very quaint, and privily he couched her be the quainta, and secretly he caught her by the quaint. Now, this is a word that is obviously used in mixed company. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to have a great deal of potency in the text, and yet in the next century, the 15th century, it transforms in its sound and in its spelling to a degree, and becomes what we now regard as probably the most potent obscenity.
Mm-hmm.
Why this change took place, of course, is not entirely clear, mm-hmm. but I suppose it's a question, actually, of course, the 19th century, the Victorian age, on one hand was extremely puritanical, mm-hmm. and on the other they were also mm-hmm. supported strongly a great deal of sexual mm-hmm. stories and books, which we would today regard as very obscene.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Spector?
That's absolutely right, and at the same time we can detect a greater sense of power in the use of words that today we would find without power. Mm-hmm. So we saw before the swearing by blood and bones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a theological context in the medieval period, that had significance because what it involved was swearing by God's body and bones, and often sermons say the people who utter such great oaths are re-crucifying Jesus.
Well, this is also sort of inviting the bolt from the blue, is it not? It's about as strong as you can get.
Yeah, that was powerful language in this context, whereas the word quaint is not. Mm-hmm. Now, to give an even more forceful example, and there are descriptions in the general prologue of the Canterbury Tales of most of the pilgrims, mm-hmm. And probably the most admirable is the parson. And yet in the description of the parson, the narrator Chaucer says, the pilgrim Chaucer says, he liked to set a good model, a good example for his congregation, because after all, how could you have a shitten shepherd and a clean sheep?
Mm-hmm.
Now, unless Chaucer is subverting his portrait of this admirable character, it tells us that the word really didn't have much power. Whereas today it doesn't.
Uh-huh.
Let's get back to the plot of the Miller's Tale. Nicholas has arranged his tryst with Alison, and he thacks her upon the loins well, which is a recollection of the land of cocaine, and a complication is introduced into the plot when yet another young man falls in love with Alison. This guy's name is Absalom. He's dressed like a fop. He wears shoes that have extensive carvings on them. He wears delicate hosiery, and he's somewhat squeamish, we're told. He falls so deeply in love with her that the narrator says if she had been a mouse and he a cat, he would have seized her at once. So he goes to woo her, and she's totally unimpressed. However, the complications in the plot have been established. Nicholas's plan is that he will go to his room and not come out for a period of time. When Allison's husband returns, he's worried about Nicholas. What's wrong with him? Well, he goes up to Nicholas's room ultimately and finds him in a stupor. What's wrong? I've had a vision, says Nicholas. There's going to be another flood. In fact, he says, there's going to fall a rain on Monday night that's so wild that half so great was never Noah's flood. This world, he said, in less than an hour shall be drenched.
All right, now let me stop you, Steve Inspector. Here we have a set of cultural and theological and religious circumstances entering into this, into the Miller's Tale, that wouldn't necessarily make sense in the same way to a modern audience that it did to a medieval audience. Much more real, much more immediate. Do I have that right?
Well, that's right. It's also true that the medieval audience and much of the modern audience would recognize that carpenter has forgotten God's promise.
Yeah. Well, now you remember that we live in an age when if you say Moses to a teenager, most of the time the kid's going to say a basketball player. Take it from there.
Well, God's covenant in the story in Genesis after the flood is that he will never again destroy the earth through water.
Mm-hmm.
The carpenter has forgotten that. Well, anyway, the plan is that because there's going to be another flood, Noah's flood is going to come again, the plan that the clerk suggests is that they set up three kneading tubs from the roof of the building, and that each of them, the night before the flood comes, goes to sleep in one tub. Then when the flood arrives, they can cut the rope, and they will be saved, and they'll be rulers of the world.
All right, from that point, Morton Bloomfield, what happens in the Miller's Tale?
Well, there is the story of Absalom. What goes on just before they get themselves into these little tubs that they're going to be mm-hmm. going into. Absalom makes an attempt to get this young woman whom he is so strongly in love with. He was jolly and light and went there, and she has a problem of wanting to get rid of him. He is irritating and interrupting their love affair. And she goes to the window her husband, the old lover, is up in a boat on close to the roof waiting for the flood.
Mm-hmm.
They had been up there, but they come down and they fall into act of love with each other at this particular time. Absalom, who is this other man who is in love with Allison and gets nowhere, is making another attempt. He goes out and sings at her bedroom, and he can't see what's going on. She goes up, and she says that she'll let him kiss her if he will go away. So what happens is she puts her backside out, and he kisses her backside, and then he flees away, full of revenge. He goes to a blacksmith and gets a hot poker, and goes up again and pretends that he wants it again. This time, Nicholas decides to go because he's being up for other purposes, standing up for other purposes. He goes out and he gets hit on the backside.
With the poker.
With the hot poker. Mm-hmm. And he screams, "Water, water!" What happens? The old man up in the sky, up in the roof, cuts the rope and calls them. Mm-hmm. And everybody laughs, and that's a great joke. This is partly medieval humor, but it really isn't very humorous.
Very, very slapstick.
But very slapstickish, uh-huh, indeed.
Stephen Spector?
And heartless as well.
And heartless.
How? In what fashion? In the sense of the comeuppance?
Well, the old
innocent
husband
man, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is an innocent man, and when he hears about the destruction to come, his first thought is my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas his wife has no concern for him, whatever. In Fabliau, there's no place for integrity and loyalty. Mm-hmm. There's no place for love.
These stories are stories for people who were more used to the imagination and the use of the imagination, I think, than moderns. Moderns get the imaginations presented before them. They see them as well as hear about them when they get hear a TV show. Of some sort, and
we're more passive somehow.
We're much more passive than they were. They participate. Mm-hmm. Chaucer was writing at the end of a very heavily oral period, in mm-hmm. which writing was becoming more and more important. But in the 15th century, what was invented? But printing,
mm-hmm.
and printing made the whole situation different. Where you could pass out copies of stories to all sorts of people or mm-hmm. sell them.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, his stories are no longer quite the same.
So the questions of format and marketing enter into
that's right.
The
exactly.
transition.
Marketing is extremely important. Yeah. What happened with the invention of printing was, in a sense, a very important change mm-hmm. that took place. Changed the whole world in mm-hmm. many, many ways. On the other hand, some of Chaucer's poetry, especially his other great work, Troilus and Cresseida, is a magnificent story of great serious dimensions
uh-huh, uh-huh.
and very, very important. But they are stories, and they're marvelous stories, and that is what tells us something about human nature, tells us something about life, it tells us something about where we're going and what we've come from.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about humor in medieval English literature. My guests were Morton Bloomfield of Harvard University and Stephen Spector of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Spector worked on a forthcoming edition of medieval English drama. Morton Bloomfield is a founding trustee of the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Medieval English Humor, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations with two recent visitors at the center, Allison Jagger of the University of Cincinnati and Martha Vicinas of the University of Michigan. Our topics will be women, philosophy, and literature. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a conversation about the light side of the Dark Ages, medieval English humor. Wayne's guests are scholars from Harvard University and the State University of New York at Stony Brook. How did medieval English sound, and what did people in the Middle Ages find humorous? The Light Side of the Dark Ages. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.